Chapter 17. Magdescu must have made things very clear to the board of directors, and the urgency of the message must have gotten through to them. For it was within quite a reasonable time indeed that word reached Andrew that the corporation was willing to do business with him. USRMM would build and design the combustion chamber and install it in his android body at its own expense. And it was prepared to enter into negotiations for a licensing arrangement covering manufacture and distribution of the entire range of prosthetic organs that Andrew might have under development. Under Andrew's supervision, a prototype metabolic converter was constructed and extensively tested at a newly constructed facility in Northern California, first within robot hulls, then with newly fabricated android bodies that had not been equipped with positronic brains and were operated on external life support systems. The results were impressive, everyone agreed, and finally Andrew declared that he was ready to have the device installed in himself. "You're absolutely certain?" Magdescu asked. The bouncy little director of research looked concerned. During the course of the project, Magdescu and Andrew had developed a curious but sturdy friendship, for which Andrew was quietly grateful now that none of the Charneys were left. In the time since Paul Charney's death, Andrew had come clearly to recognize that he needed some sort of sense of close connection with human beings. He knew now that he did not want to be a completely solitary creature, that in fact he could not exist comfortably in total solitude, though he was not sure why. Nothing in the design of the robot brain mandated any need for companionship, but it often seemed to Andrew, now that he was more like a human in many ways than he was like a robot, although he understood that he really existed in a strange, indefinable limbo, neither man nor machine partaking of some characteristics of each. "Yes," he said, "I have no doubts that the work will be done skillfully and well." "I'm not talking about our part of the work," said Magdescu. "I'm talking about yours. You can't possibly doubt that the combustion chamber will work. The tests leave no question of that."
"Then what?"
"I've been against this thing from the start, Andrew, as you know. But I don't think you fully understand why. It's because you think that the radical technological upheaval that my prosthetics will cause for U.S. robots is going to be too much for the company to handle."
"No, absolutely not. Not even remotely. I'm all in favor of experiment for the sake of experimentation. Don't you think I want to see some forward movement in this damned field of ours, after all these decades of stupid and furtive backscuttling toward ever more simple-minded and now downright brainless robots? No, Andrew, it's you that I'm worried about."
"But if the combustion chamber..." Magdescu threw up his hands.
"It's safe, it's safe. Nobody disagrees on that score. But look, Andrew, we'll be opening your body and taking out your atomic cell and installing a bunch of revolutionary new equipment, and then we'll be hooking everything up to your positronic pathways. What if something goes wrong with your body during the operation? There's always a possibility of that. Small, maybe, but real. You aren't just a positronic brain sitting inside a metal framework anymore, you know. Your brain is linked to the android housing in a far more complex way now. I know how they must have had to do the transfer operation. Your positronic pathways are tied into simulated neural pathways. Suppose your android body starts malfunctioning on the operating table. Suppose it begins to enter a terminal malfunction, Andrew.
Dies? Is that what you're trying to say?
Dies, yes. Your body begins to die. There'll be a backup android body sitting on the table right next to it. And what if we can't make the transfer in time? If your positronic brain suffers irreversible decay while we're trying to untangle it from the million and one linkages that were set up in Smythe Robertson's time and lift it over to the backup body. Your positronic brain is you, Andrew. There's no way to back up a brain, positronic or otherwise. If it's damaged, it's damaged for good. If it's damaged beyond a certain point, you'll be dead.
And this is why you're hesitant about the operation?
You're the only one of you that there is. I'd hate to lose you.
I'd hate to lose me too, Alvin. But I don't think it's going to happen. Magdescu looked bleak.
You insist on going through with it, then?
I insist. I have every faith in the skill of the staff at U.S. Robots. And that was where the matter rested. Magdescu was unable to budge him, and once more Andrew made the journey eastward to the U.S. Robots Research Center, where an entire building had been reconfigured to serve as the operating theater. Before he went, he took a long, solitary stroll one afternoon along the beach, under the steep, rugged cliffs, past the swarming tide pools where Miss and Little Miss had liked to play in their childhood of a century and more ago, and stood for a long while looking out at the dark, turbulent sea, the vast arch of the sky, the white flecks of cloud in the west. The sun was beginning to set. It cast a golden track of light across the water. How beautiful it all was. The world was really in an extraordinarily splendid place, Andrew told himself. The sea, the sky, a sunset, a glossy leaf shining with the morning dew. Everything. Everything. And, he thought, perhaps he was the only robot who had ever been able to respond to the beauty of the world in this way. Robots were a dull, plodding bunch in the main. They did their jobs, and that was that. It was the way they were supposed to be. It was the way everyone wanted them to be.
You're the only one of you that there is, Magdescu had said.
Yes, it was true. He had a capacity for aesthetic response that went far beyond the emotive range of any other robot there had ever been.
Beauty meant something to him. He appreciated it when he saw it. He had created beauty himself. And if he never saw any of this again, how very sad that would be. And then Andrew smiled at his own foolishness. Sad? For whom? He would never know it if the operation should fail. The world in all its beauty would be lost to him, but what would that matter? He would have ceased to function. He would be permanently out of order. He would be dead. And after that, it would make no difference to him at all that he could no longer perceive the beauties of the world. That was what death meant, a total cessation of function, an end to all processing of data. There were risks, yes, but they were risks he had to take, because otherwise... He simply had to. There was no otherwise. He could not go on as he was, outwardly human in form, more or less, but incapable of the most basic human biological functions. Breathing, eating, digesting, excreting. An hour later, Andrew was on his way east. Alvin Magdescu met him in person at the U.S. Robots airstrip.
Are you ready?
Magdescu asked him.
Totally. Well then, Andrew, so am I.
Obviously, they intended to take no chances. They had constructed a wondrous operating theater for him, far more advanced in capability than the earlier room in which they had carried out his transformation from the metallic to the androidal form. It was a magnificent tetrahedral enclosure illuminated by a cross-shaped cluster of chromed fixtures at its summit that flooded the room with brilliant but not glaring light. A platform midway between floor and ceiling jutted from one wall, dividing the great room almost in half. And atop this platform rested a dazzling, transparent aseptic bubble within which the surgery would be performed. Beneath the platform that supported the bubble was the surgical stage's environmental support apparatus, an immense cube of dull green metal housing an intricate tangle of pumps, filters, heating ducts, reservoirs of sterilizing chemicals, humidifiers, and other equipment. On the other side of the room was a great array of supplementary machinery covering an entire wall, an autoclave, a laser bank, a host of metering devices, a camera boom and associated playback screens that would allow consulting surgeons outside the operating area to monitor the events.
What do you think?
Magdescu asked proudly.
Very impressive. I find it most reassuring and highly flattering as well. You know that we don't want to lose you, Andrew. You're a very important individual.
Andrew did not fail to notice the slight hesitation in Magdescu's voice before that last word. As though Magdescu had been about to say man and had checked himself just barely in time, Andrew smiled thinly but said nothing. The operation took place the next morning, and it was an unqualified success. There turned out to be no need for any of the elaborate safety devices that the U.S. robots people had set up. The operating team, following procedures that Andrew himself had helped to devise, went briskly about the task of removing his atomic cell, installing the combustion chamber, and establishing the new neural linkages, and performed its carefully choreographed work without the slightest hitch. Half an hour after it was over, Andrew was sitting up, checking his positronic parameters, exploring the altered data flow surging through his brain as a torrent of messages came in from the new metabolic system. Magdescu stood by the window watching him. How do you feel?
Fine. I told you there'd be no problems. Yes, yes. As I said, my faith in the skill of your staff was unwavering, and now it's done. I have the ability to eat.
So you do. You can sip olive oil at any rate.
That's eating. I'm told that olive oil has a delicious taste.
Well, sip all you want. It'll mean occasional cleaning of the combustion chamber, as of course you already realize. Something of a nuisance, I'd say, but there's no way around it.
A nuisance for the time being, Andrew said.
But it's not impossible to make the chamber self-cleaning. I've already had some ideas about that,
and other things.
Other things? Magdescu asked.
Such as?
A modification that will deal with solid food.
Solid food is going to contain incombustible fractions, Andrew. Indigestible matter, so to speak. That's going to have to be discarded.
I'm aware of that.
You would have to equip yourself with an anus.
The equivalent.
The equivalent, yes. What else are you planning to develop for yourself, Andrew?
Everything else.
Everything?
Everything, Alvin. Magdescu tugged at the point of his beard and raised one eyebrow.
Genitalia, too?
I don't see any reason why not. Do you?
You aren't going to be able to give yourself any kind of reproductive ability. You simply aren't, Andrew.
Andrew managed a faint smile. As I understand it, human beings make use of their genitalia even at times when they don't have the slightest interest in reproduction. In fact, they seem to use them for reproduction only once or twice in their lifetimes, at best. Is that not so? And the rest of the time...
Yes, Magdescu said.
I know, Andrew. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that I plan to have sexual relations with anyone, Andrew said. I tend to doubt very much that I would, but I want the anatomical features to be present all the same. I regard my body as a canvas on which I intend to draw... He left the sentence unfinished. Magdescu stared at him, waiting for the next word. When it seemed certain that it would not be forthcoming, he completed the statement himself, and this time Magdescu spoke the word that he had not been able to bring himself to utter on the day before the operation.
A man, Andrew? A man. Yes, perhaps.
Magdescu said,
I'm disappointed in you. It's really such a puny ambition. You're better than a man, Andrew. You're superior in every way I can think of. Your body is disease-proof, self-sustaining, self-repairing, virtually invulnerable, a marvelously elegant example of biological engineering just as it stands. It doesn't need any improvements.
But no, for some reason you want to put totally useless food inside yourself and then find a way of excreting it. You want to give yourself genitalia even though you aren't capable of reproduction and aren't interested in sex.
You'll want to start having body odor next and dental decay.
He shook his head scornfully.
I don't know, Andrew.
The way it seems to me, you've been going downhill ever since you opted for organicism.
My brain hasn't suffered. No, it hasn't. I'll grant you that. But there's no guarantee that this new set of upgrades that you've started to sketch out won't involve you in tremendous risks once we start the actual installations. Why take chances? You've got very little to gain and everything to lose.
You are simply not capable of seeing this from my viewpoint, Alvin.
No. No, I guess not. I'm a mere flesh and blood human being who doesn't think there's anything very wonderful about perspiration and excretion and skin blemishes and headaches. You see this beard I wear? I wear it because hair insists on growing on my face every single day. Useless, bothersome, ugly hair. Some kind of evolutionary survival from God knows what primordial phase of human life. And I have my choice between going to the bother of removing it every single day so that I'll conform to the conventional neatness modes of my society, or else letting it grow on at least some areas of my face so that I can be spared the nuisance of depilation. Is that what you want, facial hair? Stubble, Andrew? Do you intend to devote all your immense technical ingenuity to the challenging task of finding out a way of creating 5 o'clock shadow for yourself?
You can't possibly understand, said Andrew.
So you keep saying. I understand this, though. You've developed a patented line of prosthetic devices that amounts to an immense technological breakthrough. They're going to extend the human lifespan enormously and transform the existence of millions of people who otherwise would be facing crippling and debilitating circumstances as they age. I realize that you're wealthy already, but once your devices are on the market, they'll make you rich beyond anybody's comprehension. Maybe having more money doesn't mean much to you, but there'll be fame along with it, honors galore, the gratitude of an entire world. It's an enviable position, Andrew. Why can't you settle for what you have now? Why take all these crazy chances and run the risk of losing everything? Why do you insist on playing further games with your body?
Andrew did not answer. Nor did he let any of Alvin Magdescu's objections prevent him from continuing to follow his chosen path. With the basic principles of his prosthetic devices established, he was able to develop a host of new applications involving virtually every organ of the body. And everything went pretty much as Magdescu had said it would, the money, the honors, the fame. But the personal risks of which Magdescu had spoken did not materialize. The frequent upgrades which Andrew underwent over the next decade had no harmful effects whatever, as they brought his android body closer and closer in its operational systems to the human norm. The Feingold and Charney people had helped him to draft and negotiate the licensing agreement under which all the patent-protected prosthetic devices developed by Andrew Martin Laboratories would be manufactured and marketed by United States Robots and Mechanical Men on a royalty payment basis. Andrew's patents were airtight, and the contract was a highly favorable one. Whatever irritation or resentment U.S. Robots might have felt all these years over the mere fact of Andrew's existence was forgotten, or at least put aside. Willy-nilly, they had to treat him with respect. He and the company were partners now. U.S. Robots established a special division to produce Andrew's devices, with factories on several continents and in low orbit. Marketing experts from the parent company were brought in to develop plans for distributing the new products everywhere on Earth and the space settlements. Surgeons, both human and robot, underwent courses of instruction at the U.S. Robots Prosthetics Facility so that they would be able to carry out the complicated installation procedures. Demand for Andrew's prosthetic devices was immense. The flow of royalties was heavy right from the start and within a few years became overwhelming. Andrew now owned the entire Martin Charney estate, and much of the surrounding land, a wondrous stretch of cliff-top terrain overlooking the Pacific Ocean for 8 or 10 kilometers. He lived in Sir's big house, but maintained his own old cottage nearby as a sentimental reminder of his early days of independent life after gaining free robot status. Farther down the property, he built the imposing research facilities of Andrew Martin Laboratories. There was a little trouble with the zoning authorities about that, because this was supposed to be a quiet residential area, and the research center that Andrew wanted to set up would be the size of a small university campus. There was also, perhaps, some lingering anti-robot feelings at work among the opposition. But when his application came up for approval, Andrew's lawyer simply said,
"Andrew Martin has given the world the prosthetic kidney, the prosthetic lung, the prosthetic heart, the prosthetic pancreas. In return, all he asks is the right to continue his research in peace on the property where he has lived and worked for well over 100 years. Who among us would refuse such a small request when it comes from so great a benefactor of mankind?"
And after a certain amount of debate, the zoning variance was granted, and the buildings of the Andrew Martin Laboratories Research Center began to rise amid the somber cypresses and pines of what had long ago been the wooded estate of Gerald Martin. Every year or two, Andrew would return to the gleaming operating theater at U.S. Robots for additional prosthetic upgrading of his own. Some of the changes were utterly trivial ones. The new fingernails and toenails, for example, virtually indistinguishable now from those of humans. Some of the changes were major. The new visual system, which, although synthetically grown, was able to duplicate the human eyeball in virtually every respect.
Don't blame us if you come out of this permanently blind,
Magdescu told him sourly when Andrew went to him for the eye transplant. You aren't looking at this rationally, my friend, replied Andrew. The worst that can happen to me is that I will be forced to go back to photo-optic cells. There is no risk whatever that I will suffer complete loss of eyesight.
Well,
Magdescu said and shrugged. Andrew was right, of course. No one was forced to be permanently blind anymore. But there were artificial eyes, and then there were artificial eyes. And the photo-optic cells that had been a feature of Andrew's original android body were replaced with the new synthetic organic eyes that Andrew Martin Laboratories had perfected. The fact that hundreds of thousands of aging human beings had been content for more than a generation to use photo-optic cells was irrelevant to Andrew. To him, they looked artificial. They looked inhuman. He had always wanted true eyes, and now he had them. Magdescu, after a while, gave up protesting. He had come to see that Andrew was destined to have his way in all things and that there was no point in raising objections to Andrew's schemes for new prosthetic upgrades. Besides, Magdescu was beginning to grow old now, and much of the fire and zeal that had been characteristic of him when Andrew first came to him had gone out of him by now. Already he had several major prosthetic operations himself. A double kidney replacement, first, and then a new liver. Soon Magdescu would reach retirement age. And then, no doubt, he would die in 10 or 20 years more, Andrew told himself. Another friend gone, swept away by the remorseless river of time. Andrew himself, naturally, showed no signs of aging at all. For a time, that troubled him enough that he debated having some cosmetic wrinkles added, a touch of crow's feet around his eyes, for example, and graying his hair. After giving the matter a little thought, though, he decided that to go in for such things would be a foolish affectation. Andrew did not see his upgrades that way at all. They represented his continued attempt to leave his robot origins behind and approach the physical form of a human being. He did not deny to himself that it had become his goal to do that. But there was no sense in becoming more human than the humans themselves. It struck him as pointless and absurd to subject his ever more human but still ageless android body to the external markings of aging. Vanity had nothing to do with Andrew's decision, only logic. He was aware that humans had always tried to do everything in their power to conceal the effects that growing old had on their appearance. Andrew realized that it would be altogether ridiculous for him, exempted as he was from aging by his inherent android nature, to go out of his way deliberately to take those effects upon himself. So he remained ever youthful-looking, and of course there was never any slackening of his physical vigor. A careful maintenance program made certain of that. But the years were passing, and passing swiftly now. Andrew was approaching the 150th anniversary of his construction. By this time, Andrew was not only exceedingly wealthy, but covered with the honors that Alvin Magdescu had foretold for him. Learned societies hastened to offer him fellowships and awards. In particular, one society which was devoted to the new science he had established. The one he had called Robobiology, but which had come to be termed Prosthetology. He was named its honorary president for life. Universities vied with one another to give him degrees. An entire room in his house, the one upstairs that once had been his woodworking studio 5 generations before, was given over now to storing the myriad diplomas, medals, scrolls of honor, testimonial volumes, and other artifacts of Andrew's worldwide status as one of humanity's greatest benefactors. The desire to recognize Andrew's contribution became so universal that he needed one full-time secretary simply to reply to all the invitations to attend testimonial banquets or accept awards and degrees. He rarely did attend any such ceremonies any longer, though he was unfailingly courteous in refusing, explaining that the continued program of his research made it inadvisable for him to do a great deal of traveling. But in fact, most of these functions had come to irritate and bore him. The first honorary degree from a major university had given him a thrill of vindication. No robot had ever received such an honor before. But the 50th honorary degree, the 100th, they had no meaning for him. They said more about the giver than about the recipient. Andrew had proved whatever point it was that he had set out to make about his intelligence and creativity long ago, and now he simply wanted to proceed with his work in peace, without having to make long trips and listen to speeches in his honor. He was surfeited with honor. Boredom and irritation, Andrew knew, were exceedingly human traits, and it seemed to him that he had only begun to experience them in the past 20 or 30 years. Previously, so far as he could recall, He had been notably free from such afflictions, though from the beginning there had always been a certain unrobotic component of impatience in his makeup that he had chosen not to acknowledge for a long time. This new irritability, though, it was some side effect of the upgrades, he suspected, but not a troublesome one, at least not so far. When his 150th anniversary came around and the U.S. Robots people let it be known that they wanted to hold a great testimonial dinner to mark the occasion, Andrew instructed his secretary, with some annoyance in his voice, to turn the invitation down. "Tell them I'm deeply touched, etc., etc., the usual stuff. But that I'm busy right now with an extremely complex project, etc., etc., and that in any case I'd just as soon not have a lot of fuss made over the anniversary. But I thank them very much, I understand the great significance of the gesture, and so forth, etc., etc., etc." Usually a letter like that was enough to get him off the hook, but not this time. Alvin Magdescu called him and said, "Look, Andrew, you can't do this."
"Can't do what?"
"Toss the USRMM testimonial dinner back in their faces like that."
"But I don't want it, Alvin."
"I realize that. All the same, you've got to go through with it. Once in a while, you need to get out of that laboratory of yours and sit around letting a bunch of human beings bore you silly by telling you how remarkable you are."
"I've had quite enough of that over the past decade or two, thank you."
"Then you have a little more. You don't want to offend me, do you, Andrew?"
"You? What do you have to do with this? Why is it any concern of yours?"
Magdescu was 94 years old now, and had retired 6 years before.
"Because," said Magdescu bitterly, "I was the one who suggested the whole thing. As a way of demonstrating my affection for you, you damned working scrap heap. And also to express my thanks for the assortment of fantastic Andromartan prosthetic devices that have turned me into the same sort of scrap heap and permitted me to go on living as long as I have. I was going to be the master of ceremonies, the principal speaker. But no, Andrew, you simply can't be bothered, which makes me look extremely foolish. The finest creation that U.S. robots and mechanical men ever brought into this world. And you can't take a single evening off to accept acknowledgement of that fact and to give an old friend a little pleasure. A little pleasure, Andrew."
Magdescu fell silent. His face, weathered now and gray-bearded, stared at Andrew somberly out of the screen. "Well, then," Andrew said, abashed. And so he agreed to go to the testimonial dinner after all. A chartered U.S. Robots luxury flitter picked him up and flew him to the company headquarters. The dinner, in the grand wood-paneled meeting hall of the great robotics complex, had some 300 guests, all of them attired in the antiquated and uncomfortable clothing that was still considered proper formal dining costume for great occasions. And it was a great occasion. Half a dozen members of the regional legislature were there, and one of the justices of the World Court, and five or six Nobel Prize laureates, and of course a scattering of Robertsons and Smythes and Smythe Robertsons, along with a wide assortment of other dignitaries and celebrities from all over the world.
"So you showed up after all," Magdescu said. "I had my doubts right up to the last."
Andrew was struck by how small and bent Magdescu looked, how frail, how weary. But there was still a glow of the old mischief in the man's eyes. "You know I could not have stayed away," Andrew told him. "Not really."
"I'm glad, Andrew.
You're looking good."
"And so are you, Alvin." Magdescu smiled ruefully.
"You get more and more human all the time, don't you? You lie just like one of us now. And how easily that bit of flattery rolled off your lips, Andrew. You didn't even hesitate."
"There is really no law against a robot's telling an untruth to a human being," said Andrew. "Unless the untruth would do harm, of course. And you do look good to me, Alvin."
"For a man my age, you mean?"
"Yes, for a man your age, I suppose, I should say. If you insist on my being so precise." The after-dinner speeches were the usual orotund, pompous things. Expressions of admiration and wonder over Andrew's many achievements. One speaker followed another, and they all seemed ponderous and dreary to Andrew, even those who in fact managed a good bit of wit and grace. Their styles of delivery might vary, but the content was always the same. Andrew had heard it all before, many too many times. And there was an unspoken subtext in each speech that never ceased to trouble him. The patronizing implication that he had done wonderful things for a robot. That it was close to miraculous that a mere mechanical construction like himself should have been able to think so creatively and to transmute his thoughts into such extraordinary accomplishments. Perhaps it was the truth, but it was a painful truth for Andrew to face, and there seemed no way of escaping it. Magdescu was the last to speak. It had been a very long evening, and Magdescu looked pale and tired as he stood up. But Andrew, who was seated next to him, observed him making a strenuous effort to pull himself together, raising his head high, squaring his shoulders, filling his lungs, his Andrew Martin Laboratory's prosthetic lungs, with a deep draught of air.
My friends, I won't waste your time repeating the things that everyone else has heard here tonight. We all know what Andrew Martin has done for mankind. Many of us have experienced his work at first hand. For I know that sitting before me tonight as I speak are scores of you who have Andrew's prosthetic devices installed in your bodies, and I am of your number. So I want to say, simply, that it was my great privilege to work with Andrew Martin in the early days of prosthetology, for I myself played a small part in the development of those devices of his which are so essential to our lives today. And in particular, I want to acknowledge that I would not be here tonight but for Andrew Martin. But for him and his magnificent work, I would have been dead 15 or 20 years ago, and so would many of you. Therefore, my friends, let me propose a toast. Lift your glasses with me now and take a sip of this good wine in honor of the remarkable individual who has brought such great changes to medical science, and who today attains the imposing and significant age of 150 years. I give you, my friends, Andrew Martin, the sesquicentennial robot.
Andrew had never managed to cultivate a liking for wine or even any understanding of its merits. But as a result of his combustion chamber upgrades, at least he had the physiological capacity to consume it. Sometimes he actually did, when social context seemed to require him to. And so when Alvin Magdescu turned toward him, therefore, his eyes shining with emotion, his face flush, his glass upraised, Andrew raised his own glass in response and downed a long drink of the wine that it contained. But in fact, he felt little joy. Though the sinews of his face had long since been redesigned to display a range of emotions, he had sat through the entire evening looking solemnly passive, and even at this climactic moment, he could manage nothing better than a perfunctory half-smile. Even that took effort. Magdescu had meant well, but his words had given Andrew pain. He did not want to be a sesquicentennial robot.